Hi, welcome to Cloud Cover. My name is Steve Dunn.
And I'm Ryan Marks.
We got a great show this week. We are going to be covering your questions.
Yep.
That's right. We've asked you to submit via the Twitters your favorite or your most wanted or your most interested or whatever questions you have. Now, the rules of this were they were supposed to be questions. In reality, most of these were comments.
A lot of these were not really questions.
Yeah, if you
we received over 10,000 responses
yeah.
to that first tweet that asked for questions. Not everyone
got the model. There were quite a few questions, though, about whether or not we wanted Cialis,
yeah.
I think.
And we'll be following up offline to those people who made those generous offers.
Yes, indeed. Apparently you can get it very cheap these days.
Yep, that's what I hear.
Now, the questions that we have, we're going to address them in no particular order.
Mm-hmm.
However, we're going to attempt to answer them to the best of our abilities, assuming they were phrased in the Jeopardy form of a question.
Right.
Okay, so before we get to that, let's do the news.
Let's do some news.
Yeah.
So this first one, loading data to SQL Azure the fast way, which is much better, I think, than the slow way.
Yes.
Just my personal opinion, but I prefer fast.
I have found that in practice you get more done when you do things quicker than slower.
Yeah.
Now, the point of this particular post, though, is it compares and contrasts some of the different ways. BCP, which is the bulk copy utility, and then additionally the SSIS, and there might be one other in there. But anyhow, they ran it from within a role, outside of a role, and all these different things, and they actually showed multiple threads, single task, and all these kind of things. And they have a nice little graph there at the bottom that kind of shows what's the fastest. And spoiler alert, it's BCP running inside of Windows Azure worker role.
Located. Because yeah, lower is better here.
Yeah.
It's faster.
Yeah.
So the small one.
You don't want to take that big blue one, which apparently is the slowest way to do it.
SSIS from outside.
Without parallelizing it, apparently.
Yeah. No, that sounds bad. Right. So BCP from inside Windows Azure.
Yeah. And anyhow, this was just a great post. And I thought it was kind of interesting to take a look. And somebody actually did the analysis of how this works. So if you're interested, go check it out. It's on the SQL CAT blog, which apparently is customer advisory team. I'm guessing they advise customers.
And their Bria team.
Yep.
Next up, FTP to Azure Blob Storage Bridge. We covered once before an FTP solution in Windows Azure
yep.
by Martin. He has a last name. I just don't remember what it is. And actually, I just don't know how to pronounce it. I can spell it probably. And he didn't actually give source code. So he sort of described what the challenges were and whatever. But this guy, Muhammad Habib, is that? No, actually, it's a modified form of Muhammad. Who is this? Richard Parker. Richard Parker took some source code from Muhammad Habib, who did a C# FTP server, changed it into a Windows Azure worker mm-hmm. role, put it up in the cloud, lets you basically connect to your blob storage account through an FTP service, so using any standard FTP client. Sounds pretty cool. I haven't actually looked at it yet, but it's up on CodePlex, so that means there's a bunch of source code there.
There's a little bit of difference in this one, too. The Martin's original one was you pass a username account name and a key.
Yeah, like as your credentials.
And it actually routed you to that storage account, so
yep.
it was at a much higher level. This one is like multi-tenanting a single account. So the FTP service is using containers as the boundary, so a user logs in,
cool.
authenticates essentially, and then they get routed.
So you don't have
to
give that. So you could actually give out some other kind of credentials to users
exactly.
to use FTP.
That's what it sounds like, at least. Again, I haven't run this yet, but it looks cool.
Yes, I agree. This article is getting a lot of press these days. It's in the press, I guess. That's sort of by definition. But this is a New York Times article about how fast can a cloud run. It sounds like a riddle of some sort.
The answer
clouds, they float, sort of. They don't really run.
The answer is somewhere in between really fast and not fast.
Yeah, it's somewhere in between those two extremes. So this one, look, we've always got to take these things with a grain of salt. The conclusion of this thing is, hey, Windows Azure is really fast because one particular benchmark by this tool, Cloud Sleuth, which is from CompuWare, is measuring Amazon, Google App Engine, Windows Azure, and actually a couple other ones.
Might be Rackspace. Was it Rackspace?
I don't know if Rackspace was. I think Rackspace was in there, yeah. And but there was also one or two other ones, I think. And for the past 30 days or something, Windows Azure has shown the best results. But you got to always watch with these benchmark things. I don't know what it's going to show in the future, because we're not exactly sure what they're measuring. They talk a little bit about what they're measuring, but particularly with Windows Azure and Google App Engine, where it's sort of, well, it's a platform-specific implementation. It's not clear that it's apples to apples. And so I don't want to overblow this sort of thing, but it's pretty cool to see that. You can take a look, take it for what it's worth. Yeah. It's good to see Windows Azure in there doing well.
Well, like any benchmark, it's really garbage in, garbage out. You know, it all depends on the assumptions that they put in. So, you know, while this shows us on top today, it's very possible someone will come out, tweak a few parameters, and we're bottom of the deck now. So
exactly.
Who knows? And again, yeah, just take this with a grain of salt.
Yep. Up next is a mashup of, you know, Silverlight, Windows Phone 7, and Windows Azure Storage. Mm-hmm. I think it's just Windows Azure Storage. I don't think there was a service in here. But this is kind of cool. It's a four-part. This is part four of four, but you can kind of click back to the previous ones. Basically, putting together a Windows Phone 7 app, which you can kind of see down here, where there's a level editor that's the Silverlight 4 client that lets you edit levels and store them into Windows Azure Storage, and then Windows Phone 7 loads those levels from storage. It's using techniques very similar to the ones that we talked about when we talked
about Silverlight clients,
and talking to Blob Storage. So pretty cool. I haven't looked through all of this yet, but I like the idea. I like sort of putting these things together using Blob Storage for something like this. Pretty neat, and if you're also trying to figure out how to do Windows Phone 7 stuff, this might be a decent, you know, way to get started with this technology.
Now, this one is on changing the firewall settings, so programmatically, in fact.
In SQL Azure. Yep.
In SQL Azure, correct. So the SQL Azure, one of the first things you have to do is when you create that logical server that is kind of the root of where you're going to start creating your databases, you need to actually go out and configure the firewall, because by default, it's completely blocked off to everything. So the first time you go to the portal, you need to enable one firewall rule at least, which is either the Windows Azure specific one, or at least the host that you're currently connected on.
Yep.
Once you do that, you can actually connect, and it turns out the firewall rules and everything are configured in the tables themselves in SQL Azure, and there are some stored procedures that you can use to actually grant and revoke access to different IP ranges just right within SQL Azure. So it's a simple way for you to go out, create the first rule, and like you could do this in Windows Azure, for instance. Have the first rule be Windows Azure's open, then within the application, it can programmatically set it as clients require access to it.
Yep.
So, very cool tip.
Pretty cool. I like that it's just T-SQL instead of inventing a management API that takes. It's like, well, no, if you have credentials to the database and you can connect, you can just use T-SQL commands to do it. So it just does the same thing as the UI, but pretty cool. I like that. We've got one last piece of news to cover. It's a PDF, but we will share the URL later. So this was presented at Black Hat, and this is from a lead security PM in basically our data center organization, the GFS that kind of owns our data centers and runs those. So Grant Buger, I don't know. I butchered somebody's name. I apologize. But he's written a pretty nice paper this is not just about Microsoft's cloud computing stuff. This is also, basically, Amazon is the other one they cover. So he covers Windows Azure Storage, Amazon S3. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how it's a bit different. The kind of attack vectors are a little bit different from traditional, like, relational database attacks. So instead of SQL injection, you have things like query string parameter injection or XML injection.
Right.
Pretty interesting. And he talks about where you're sort of in better shape using a cloud storage thing, where... for example, a SQL injection attack can take a query and turn it into like a drop database or something. In the cloud, he talks about the fact that it's a REST API and it's either a GET request or it's a PUT request and it can't be both, means that actually some of these injection attacks are not quite as bad as they might be in other places.
Right.
And then he talks about just how they're different attack vectors, and it's just something to keep in mind. For the most part, the guidance in here is use a library. Use, for example, the storage client library or something that properly forms XML that escapes everything correctly. It's just important to point out, I think, and a great read. It's really accessible. It's a good read. And just talks about how all the stuff that you've learned about SQL injection and those common attack vectors, there are actually some different things to keep in mind in cloud storage. And if you're doing the right thing and sort of using the libraries and whatever, you're in really good shape. But here's why those things matter, and some things that if you didn't really spend a lot of time thinking about it, you might just not realize. So I encourage people to just read this, even if it's just for their education, just kind of curious what's in here.
It's only a short 30 pages or so, too, so it's not painful.
It's really not that bad, because a bunch of these are code samples and, you know, and XML and whatever. And so it's pretty good, and you can skip through some of the stuff as background, so you can actually skip ahead also to some direct kind of guidance and things like that.
So don't manually form your XML as one.
Don't string concatenate together to make XML.
I had heard of that somewhere. I think it was in like the early 1990s.
Yeah.
So it's still, this is still true today.
It is still true today.
Wow, that axiom never changes.
Yep.
Okay.
All right, so with that, I guess it's time for our feature, which is really just a whole bunch of questions that have been asked.
Yeah. And remember, there were 10,000
at least, last time I checked.
Questions.
But they were coming in at about 5 a minute, so even today.
Yeah, we took as many as we could.
Yeah, so we're going through as many of them as we could.
So the first one here is from, it was retweeted, obviously.
Yeah, it's from Glenn.
Glenn Ferry there, right? But he tried the Kenico through WebMatrix, but couldn't get the DB to migrate to SQL Azure.
Right. So he's looking for a CMS, is what he wants, a content management system.
Yeah.
So his original question was just, hey, what's the recommendation for CMS? Then he tried this one, Kentico, and found that it wouldn't work. Somebody from Kentico replied and said, it's going to work in the future. We're just not there yet. So they're working on that. In the meantime, what do you suggest, Ryan, for other CMS options?
Caveat here is I haven't tried any of these myself because I don't need a CMS right now. However, I do know that ADX Studio, which is ADX Studio, sounds just like
it's good.
It is.
When you spell it, it's a lot clearer.
I'll spell ADX. Based out of Regina, Canada, no less.
Yeah.
Those Canadians, I tell you. Anyhow, I do know that those guys have been doing a lot with the Azure platform, and in particular, there is a version of that runs on Windows Azure. So that is one CMS.
That's one.
Now, I want to, again, say I haven't used it, and I know there's probably others, but this is one of the ones I'm aware of. So there you go.
Great. Moving along, this one was not actually on Twitter. This was a comment on one of our previous shows where we were talking about, what were we talking about in this show? ASP.NET providers, but this question really didn't have anything to do with that. This question is from Fabio, apparently, who would like to know.
I saw him once in person. It looks just
like
that
Fabio?
Picture.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, it just looks just like that, except older.
Okay. That makes sense, I guess.
Yeah.
So
still has that mane of hair.
This question, there are actually two questions here, which is kind of cheating, but this wasn't a Twitter thing, so we'll let it slide here. Two questions. One was dev, staging, and production. What's the difference between the environments, and how do you manage configuration changes? How do you make sure your dev stuff is pointing to dev and your testing points to different set? Mostly data, I think, is the question. How do you make sure you're pointing to the right database for these things? What do you do?
So I think the guidance I give for the differences between the environments, we can talk about the differences between the environments and get into the details, but the guidance I give to people running production QA test and dev is, in general, you're going to want your production instance, today at least, to be in a different subscription than your test and QA and whatnot. And the reason is the subscription is really the boundary for admin. So a single live ID has the ability to manage a given subscription. And that is also true of our management API, where a certificate, up to 5 certificates, actually can manage a subscription. So what you would do typically is, for your dev environment, you'd give a certificate to your developers, and they would have essentially free rein to do whatever they needed to in the dev environment. And as long as your production environment is in a different sub, there's no chance they could accidentally or purposefully overwrite something in the production environment. You want to hang on to that and give that certificate to your IT folks, who are really your build managers and whatnot, and let them promote it through. Now, you can get more granular and you can say, well, look, the test environment has to be different than the dev as well, and then you would have another subscription. I think the minimum bar really is the production needs to be in a different sub than your dev, test, and QA.
This is assuming you have different people in your organization responsible for these different things. Obviously, if you're Fabio and you can do it all yourself, which I assume Fabio can, then it would be okay to put these things together. But you may want to do it just to make sure you don't accidentally
Yeah, it's really an accidental thing. And the other is sometimes there's auditing requirements of who has access to a given environment, and especially for production, that makes a difference. And if you can say, look, there is no one in the organization except for these three named individuals that can possibly access production,
right?
That's the auditing requirement satisfied. So,
yep.
So again, you take a look at this. It makes sense for you. Go ahead and do that. But that's how it works today, at least. So
two other aspects of this I want to briefly talk about. Mm-hmm. And one is the difference between the different environments and whatever. And there's sort of there's a big difference between local development and running in the cloud. Aside from that, Windows Azure doesn't differentiate. We don't care if you happen to think of this as your staging or your QA or
right.
or your vNext that we're working on or whatever. We treat it all the same way. We do have two slots in the portal, staging and production, that you can swap between. And really the only difference between those is a URL. The staging one gets this GUID, .cloudapp.net, while production gets your production URL attached to it. So. In terms of, you know, what happens, whatever, there is a big difference running locally. It's running processes on your machine. There are some gotchas sort of on dev storage versus real storage and things. That's actually different. Once you deploy to the cloud, it's all the same. So everything's going to work the same way. Everything has the same types of options, et cetera. So there isn't a big difference there. It's really up to you to kind of decide how you want to use these different environments. And then the other aspect I want to touch on is, how do you manage the configuration differences between, like, I'm going to deploy to QA, you know, to mm-hmm. do some tests. I'm running against some test set of data. I don't want to affect the production data set. And the best practice here is to use configuration settings. So use in serviceconfiguration.cscfg, or if you're in Visual Studio, it's just one of the configuration settings when you double-click on a role. Mm-hmm. Use those, because those you can update at runtime. And so, depending on what you're doing, if you're just deploying here and then you're just going to take that, repackage it, deploy it over there, you just need to make sure that you're using the right set of configuration in the two places. If you're going to do something like do a swap between staging and production, so you're going to deploy to staging as sort of maybe just a last minute sort of smoke test kind of thing
yep.
before you go to production, you're still going to want to deploy with your non-production data potentially. What I recommend is deploy with that set of data, then go in the portal to hit the configure button, change the configuration setting to point to your production data, SQL Azure or table storage or whatever you're using, and then hit swap after that's finished.
Yep.
Right? And then take down the old version. And so basically deploy running against test data, change it to point to production data, then swap it into the production URL. That's what I would recommend. There are other ways you can deal with this, but I think that one's sort of the cleanest, you know, no downtime sort of transition where you're still very confident you can look at any time at what the configuration is and know that you did it. If you put the configuration somewhere else in the package, then after you've deployed, it's really hard to tell, is this configured right? Am I pointing at the right thing? Putting in configuration means you can always go to the portal and look and maintain that. So.
And you can also use the API. You don't have to use the portal. You can actually script out everything and say, look, change the config first, wait for it to finish, then swap
and then do the
automatically.
FIP swap. Yeah, that is a very good point. And there, so Fabio's second question here was that
third.
Steve mentioned, yes, is it third?
Third-ish.
Okay. Third-ish was that I made a sort of offhand comment about differences between development storage and Windows Azure storage in the cloud. And it was really about implementation. And what I mentioned is that locally it uses SQL Express in the back end. And so mm-hmm. it's sort of SQL-based simulation of what's in the cloud. And the question here is, what does the implementation look like in the cloud? And there's not a whole lot that we can get into here, but I think the best way to think of it is as a sort of homegrown distributed file system, then with things layered on top of that. So once you sort of have that base capability, put tables and queues and things, higher level things on there. Mm-hmm. It's much more complicated than that. But it's a custom grown system for Windows Azure that we've put together. Some of the very underlying components actually originally came from the search guys and the way that they manage their big sets of data. Since then, it's grown up a lot in terms of capabilities. But that's the story. It's not based on SQL. It's not based on any particular known technology. It's kind of custom built for Windows Azure.
Yep.
Okay. Next question on Twitter. Which hardware, server, storage array, are bundled in an Azure appliance? And can it be scaled down to a few hundred servers instead? To the question of what scale it can get at, We don't really know yet. I mean, we've been working with just these four key partners on this first kind of run of these of the Azure appliances. We'll figure it out as we go, what's really feasible, what's reasonable, what there's actually market demand for in terms of different sizes. What we've been saying to date is that the smallest is probably in the hundreds of servers range. Yep. And so that sounds kind of in line with the question here, is that it probably can get down to sort of the few hundred servers range. We don't know exactly what it's going to be when it's commercialized and, you know, and sold. We don't know what configurations are going to be available.
Yep.
To the question about hardware, it's got everything in it. It's got racks of, you know, it's got all the servers. That
hard
includes
drives.
Everything. Yeah, hard drives attached, which the storage service in Windows Azure is just another app that runs on Windows Azure. SQL Azure is similar, so these things are kind of all in the box. So all the machines, the hard drives, the networking gear is sort of all in the box. In terms of specific hardware, it's probably going to be built by a couple OEM partners, and I don't know exactly what the specific hardware is going to look like in there. It's probably going to look fairly similar to what we're
running. But it really doesn't matter. I mean, you should think of this as an appliance, and you don't really care what the chipset is inside of your, you know, Samsung
refrigerator
phone or your refrigerator, right?
You just want it
to work. Right. And kind of the guarantee here is once you purchase this appliance, it's going to run Windows Azure.
Yep.
And that's really what you need to focus on.
Great question. Moving on, this one's not really a question.
We thought it was interesting, though.
Yeah, this is our good friend Samantha J. Billinger.
Yeah, she looks a little old for you, Steve.
It's hard to tell from this picture. and she says, "Smarks, I like the new color you painted your bedroom."
A little
weird. It seems oddly personal. I see that it was posted last night via Friendstalker. I'm not familiar with that tool.
Yes. That is
kind of creepy.
Slightly disturbing.
Let's just move on. But thank you, Samantha, for your interest in the show. Dan Marino, it's a familiar sounding name.
Yeah.
Asks, we had Fabio on the show already.
Why not Dan?
Why not Dan Marino? Can a show explain how can someone have fine-grained control over load balancing? I like this follow-up, though. Or is Azure magical, and this is not needed?
I'm going to go with magical.
I think magical is actually the answer
If that
here.
Can explain everything, then we should just answer all the rest of the questions. Well, that's magic.
Magic. Magic is the answer
magic,
to these questions.
Magic,
Here's a slightly longer answer to that, which is that in Windows Azure, all inbound connections go through a hardware load balancer, which does round robin.
Yep.
And so, no, you can't really have fine-grained control over that because that part is fixed. It's just going to randomly distribute these things to your different instances. And so I'd say Azure is magical. Now, you can do some things. After it goes to that load balancer, you can reroute. I mean, you can use inter-role communication to kind of send requests to a different server. I know of a bunch of people who are doing things like that. Some people are even standing up sort of a separate role that acts as kind of a load balancing role. So the load balancer sends it to one of those, right, and then it routes it to the exact right instance.
So if you wanted sticky control over, like, you wanted every request from a particular client going to a particular instance, you would today need to front a router, essentially.
Exactly.
The other part to this that it probably good to point out is you do have in the role environment API the ability to essentially disconnect yourself from the load balancer.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So if you are doing something, there's a status health check, and it says, are you ready or are you busy? And if you set yourself to busy, you will be disconnected from the load balancer. So that is one way. I say that's kind of a hammer for a more fine-grained problem. Like, I wouldn't recommend everybody's like, well, if I have 10 instances and I want it to go to that one server
every time,
I'll tell all 9 to disconnect from the load balancer. Right. Probably not a great idea.
But you can influence load balancing that. And it's the same mechanism that makes sure that in the middle of an upgrade you're not driving traffic towards the instance that it hasn't actually come back up yet and whatever. It's the same mechanism. The load balancer obeys those things.
Right. But mostly magic.
Magic is the answer.
Okay.
Is it possible to host videos on Azure that can be used for streaming them to a Silverlight player using smooth streaming?
Steve, I think I've heard something about this.
The answer is magic.
Magic.
Down here, look, no wonder you've heard something about it. You heard it from your comment on this post.
But I didn't. I didn't write the post.
But anyway, so ZippyV, here is the answer. It's on this blog by some random guy that basically talks about how to use Windows Azure Storage as an adaptive streaming host. So I've chosen the wording carefully there, because smooth streaming kind of covers some other things. It talks about the IIS implementation of this protocol and the set of software that's associated with that. You can't run the smooth stream, the plug-in to IIS, the module in IIS that you need to run smooth streaming in Windows Azure. However, if you use this tool that I've published, or actually I've also more recently than that published an expression encoder plugin that just does it. If you use this tool, it'll basically take that smooth streaming file and break it up into little chunks, which is what it looks like over the wire. Put those up into blob storage, then you can turn on the CDN, you can use Silverlight to play those things, and it works great. So
And we know it works great because you ran Big Buck Bunny on it. And if it can run Big Buck Bunny, I'm pretty sure it can run anything.
What's with this? How did I get a scroll bar on this?
I don't know.
Some bad coding by me. Anyway, here is Big Buck Bunny. It's in this cool thing so you can graph like the frame rate you're getting and stuff like that. So anyway, proof that it works. We should just watch this for the rest of the show. It's a cute little cartoon.
I've actually never seen it except for the first few seconds with a graph in there.
I did the same while I was working on this stuff. I must have watched the first 5 seconds of this like forever, right? I finally watched the whole thing. It's actually a cute video. I like it. It's only 10 minutes long. So go watch it. Your homework, viewers of the show, is to watch Big Buck Bunny
in your own CDN.
Yeah, do that and then watch it. That's our best answer for how you can do that. You can, of course, host other kinds of videos in blob storage and get them basically to work over HTTP progressive download.
Yeah.
So you can point Silverlight or Windows Media Player or any add a video that's stored in blob storage.
And the range requests work with
range requests work, so it'll just pull down bits and pieces as it goes. So you can do that too. You don't have to use smooth streaming or any sort of adaptive streaming protocol to do it. You can use something else. But this blog post will kind of point you in the right direction.
Correct.
So Dan Marino, that name sounds extra familiar now.
apparently we didn't specify a limit on the number of questions you can ask.
I can't believe we got tens of thousands of questions and we picked two from the same person.
Yeah,
that seems really unfortunate. Can you guys have a show about the service bus? Some publish subscribe would be awesome.
I think we could do that.
I think we could probably do that. We're not going to do it right now, but we could do a show down the road. Let's just pencil that into the schedule.
Yep.
Let's find some time to just do a service bus thing. Publish subscribe is a good feature service bus we can cover. So that's it was more of a suggestion. Yeah, the answer is yes, we can.
Okay, moving on.
Roger Jennings.
Well, it's actually Roger Jen.
Okay.
So Mr. Jennings, who's a prolific blogger of all things Azure and SQL Server.
Look at his background. It's even clouds. Clouds for his background on Twitter.
Actually, it's amazing, staggering, even the number of links he tracks. I don't know. This must be his full-time job. That's the only thing I can figure out. It is just amazing. Anyhow, so his question is, when will Azure Table Storage get the promised secondary indices?
I like how he worked the word promised into there. It would have meant the same thing if he just said, hey, when will Windows Azure Tables have secondary indexes?
And we promise they will come in there.
But we promised that they are coming. They're still coming. We still promise they're coming. That's about all we have to say about
Unfortunately,
there's no more specific timeline than that. So for now, we can't really say more than that.
Yep.
But thanks for asking us, Roger.
No date, unfortunately. Now, this one came on the WCF hosting. So there's a couple things I wanted to talk about here, kind of a recap. One was, at the end of the WCF show, we said, look, add this filter thing, address filter thing.
And we said to add it to every class.
Just add it everywhere.
Just willy-nilly.
Willy-nilly.
I have a macro now. just when I hit enter, it puts in that attribute.
So we said do that. And Steve and I were both like, well, we don't really know what it does. So we still don't really know what it does, but we have found through extensive testing of my demo samples, it seems to make absolutely no difference whatsoever if you have the metadata thing fixed.
Right. So if you're using that QFE, you've put in that metadata
you don't need
thing,
it.
Then we think you never need this filter thing because the headers match up. That's our theory.
That's exactly what it is. It's the headers get passed all the way through, so you no longer have the host name in there anyways. So there's nothing to match on it as it is. Now, if you don't have this QFE and you did try to route you would run into this.
Then you'd hit this, right? Yeah. And so you could do that. If you don't depend on the metadata and whatever, you can get away without this QFE. You'll just have this weird, it'll look kind of weird as the ports come through and whatever, but it'd work. But then you're going to need this, because otherwise you're going to get this mismatch. Hey, the port doesn't match what I think I am, and it's going to break. But if you're doing the QFE thing, which is the right thing to do, you've put that little bit in web.config, then we think you can ignore this. And if it doesn't work, let us know. Because
I've tried every combination, and it made no difference.
Okay, I believe it. So I'm going to get rid of that macro.
Yeah.
It's a bad macro to have.
Now the next question really came in. One of the viewers on the show, it was, what's the name here?
Sohim Tech.
Yeah, I don't think that's his last name is Tech. That's
and his question is, what are your thoughts, or am I missing something here?
My thoughts are... Oh, should we expand?
That's the only part that's a question. The rest is sort of just commentary, I think.
So his commentary here was that in there we showed the inter-role communication, which is we had a web front end talking to a worker role that was hosting a WCF service over in the NetTCP binding. And we said, look, if you have more than one of these worker roles, there's a couple ways to do this, but typically you just want to pick one and go to it, assuming they're all running the same service and there's no state. If it's stateless, then you could just randomly pick one. And his point here was, well, that seems like a fragile way. Are you sure you want to do that? What if you forgot? I'm going to go with, I think you're still going to be okay here. The reason being is when you have to set up that endpoint, and that get random endpoint thing is a piece of code, so you couldn't really forget to do that. I don't know how you would forget in code to pick a random endpoint when it's part of
setting up the endpoint. And as long as that's the way that you do it.
Yeah, as long as you have a factory that creates the endpoint using get random endpoint, I don't know how you could forget to do it.
And so it should work basically the same way. At that point, once you've gotten one of those random ones, it's like going through a load balancer. And so I think that they're roughly equivalent. I did think of one thing at just between when we first looked at this and now. I was thinking about this more. And there is one case where if you're in the middle of like an upgrade, the load balancer is smart enough to sort of take these things out of rotation, and I think I used to be wrong about this. I was corrected a little while ago. If you enumerate those instances, you'll still get the ones that are sort of not yet in the ready state, which means although the load balancer, the hardware load balancer that you go through for a web request would ignore those ones that are down right now and route appropriately. If you do this and choose a random one, you may actually hit one in the middle of the upgrade. You may hit one that's down, and you just have to handle just. You have to handle the faults anyway, so you have to handle the fault and go away. So I think it's fine, but that is one difference. That's the only difference I can think of between going through a load balancer and going through this sort of simulated load balancer where you just
as long as you have the fault handling in your WCF service anyways with a retry logic if appropriate, whatever, you're going to be okay. There is a scenario, right, where you don't want random. Maybe you are doing some sort of sticky session thing. Well, then you wouldn't use the get random. You'd use a different strategy to find the instance you need. And that's really what it all comes down to. So
Memcached is an example then. That's how that works in the Memcached solution accelerator, right? It gets the list of everybody, and then it hashes the key and looks for the IP address that's in the right range and whatever and grabs that one. And so it's actually intelligent routing there. And that's why that's the level of access you have. You can do whatever you want there. But if you just want load balancing, choosing a random one seems okay.
Okay.
Okay, and this last one we've got, how about talking about some of the emerging design patterns for Windows Azure? Hey, that's the sort of thing that sometimes we do in a little segment we like to call Tip of the Week.
What is this? Tip of the week? It is that time.
It's once a week. There's a tip.
Yeah.
And it's the tip of that week.
Granted.
So, tip of the week, we always ask our esteemed editor, Bob, to put in some often humorous intro to the tip of the week. This week, what are you thinking? We got these questions from Twitter.
And
Samantha J. Billinger. Maybe we should dedicate this tip of the week to Samantha J. Billinger, who recently moved from Montana to the bushes outside my house.
Yeah.
And let's just let's let Bob use his imagination. I'm scared every time I say that. But Bob, why don't you have Samantha J. Billinger helping us to introduce this tip of the week?
That's great. Thank you.
And with that, here is the tip of the week. All right. Thank you very much to Samantha J. Billinger for helping out with that. And so the question here is, right, you know, what about some of these emerging design patterns such as this one? Well, I'm glad you asked, because our tip of the week is that one. Table name key pattern. I'm not actually sure that that describes very well the pattern, but here's a post about it. The post is very good. The post actually explains it very well. Yeah. I don't know about the name, but I don't have a better name, so okay. But let's talk about this a little bit.
Let's talk about the motivation for the pattern.
Yes.
Which is, you have a table. It has lots and lots of data in it.
Yep.
At some point, you want to get rid of it. You have two ways of doing this. One, you iterate through or batch through and delete entities. Two, you delete the table. Now, downside to iterating through. You have a million entities.
Slow.
You got to do
a
million.
And you only do 100 at a time in a batch, and so your deletes are not that fast either.
It can take a very long time. You rack up transaction charges, right? So there's the downside to that.
Well, let's see. A million divided by 10,000 is what, about 100? So take 10,000 transactions. So it costs a penny. So that's a very valid point, Ryan.
Yeah, well, you
wouldn't want to spend a penny.
I would say, let's say he has billions of rows.
All right,
let's
go
with that.
Fine. Thousands of pennies.
Thousands of pennies add up, man.
That is true. That's,
so the true. Other is you delete the table.
Right, but then you lost all your data.
Well,
oh
yes
my God.
And no.
What are we going to do?
The issue there is not even that. It's that this is an asynchronous delete.
It's true.
And so if you had a million rows in it, it could take...
Right, even if you actually wanted to clear everything.
Yeah, you clear everything.
And you go, okay, great, I'm just going to delete, recreate. Yep. That won't actually work that well, because it might take a while to finish that delete. In the meantime, you won't be able to reuse that table name. So you'll try to recreate, you won't be able to.
Yep.
So you have to make a new one. Actually, and I think we talked about that pattern before, of using a unique table name so that you can clear everything and just create one with a new GUID on the end or whatever. This is another answer
this
for
is,
that.
This is a variation on
which
this.
Covers both... What if I don't want to delete everything?
Mm-hmm.
And what if I do want to delete everything, but I want to keep using, I want to keep going where I was or something like that? This does something. And let me go to the whiteboard, because I want to talk briefly about some theory that goes into this, which is that everybody knows that the unique key for a table entity is partition key plus row key. Right? So within a table, you have many partitions, potentially, and within that, potentially, many rows. The row is unique within a partition. Row plus partition is unique within a table. But hey, look, the key insight into this is that really the uniqueness of an entity within a storage account is really this. It's the table name plus the partition key plus the row key. Because you can have the same partition key and row key in a different table. And so what's described in this post is basically the idea of, think about the table name being sort of part of this, and what's unique about partition key is that everything within the same partition you can do batch transactions on. So that's, it's good to put things in the same partition that you're going to do batch transactions on. The neat thing about the table is that everything in the same table can be deleted altogether. And so back to Ryan's point about deleting the table, if all these are within the same table, you can delete them. And so the scheme that's outlined in this blog post, let's come back and sort of scroll down to that. But if you look at the scheme in here, he's suggesting use a table name that has something like the date in it and put your, in this case, it's log entries. And so, mm-hmm. so use a table name that says log underscore and then the date, and put partition key, row key, and the messages within that. Here's another one for a different date. And that way, when you want to go back and delete ones that are 30 days old, you just go back 30 days, find the table name that says that day, and just delete it.
Yep, or start whacking tables greater than this range.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so it basically gives you one more grouping mechanism. You know, row key is individual entities. Partitions is groups of those row keys within a table. And then tables can actually be used as a way of grouping entities further. Now, of course, you can't do a query that spans multiple tables in a single query. So you'd have to, if you ever need to do that, you'd have to think that part through.
Right.
You could fan out queries or things like that. But if you have a pattern like this, which actually a lot of people do, this is a great way to deal with it. So I think this is just a great pattern. I think people should use this, should think about this sort of thing. There's some other patterns linked down here, hash partitioning, transaction. I haven't looked at these ones, but
I actually did.
Those are great. You did?
Yeah. They're not bad.
Ryan always prepares more than I do for the show.
I thought it was interesting because I saw the also C, and I think we know these, but we don't give them names.
Yeah.
And so I think this is like an interesting.
Exactly. It's nice to actually keep a list and give them names and have a way to talk about them with each other.
Right. You know, like the ascending or the. Is it the chronological query pattern? It's essentially the technique that you use for your block.
Daytime max value minus
exactly, and, and pad it 19 digits. So you know if in the year 9000,
it's good to have a name for it. Yep.
You know you need a blog entry of the year 9000. It still works.
Yep.
All right. Well, this is I think it's great. These guys, .NET Solutions from the UK.
Yes.
Great little company out there. They've actually been out here to Redmond. I know a couple times. I've met some of the folks.
Yeah, I think
and
so
at
too.
Different conferences.
A yep.
Bunch of bright guys. So glad to see this. With that, I think we are done.
So
if you have more questions, you can still send them to the Cloud Cover Show. We will not answer them on this show, however. Go figure.
Yeah. Future questions will not be retroactively answered.
Yes. But we will,
we'll
try to do a recap again maybe in a couple weeks and try to address questions as they come up, or especially pertinent ones. And if you form them in a phrase of a question that is answerable in a reasonable time period, we can even address it on the show. If it's much larger, like give me the theory of Windows Azure, that is a topic that is probably too beefy for a 20-minute or in our case, 45-minute show. So with that, keep your suggestions coming, and we will see you next week.
Thanks.